Marshall Street is the last on the left of North Road heading towards Tyres before you leave the signed town limits. The road was named after William Saunders Marshall, who, as a small boy, was loaded up along with his family's possessions on top of a bullock and cart. He was born in Portland, but travelled to Narracan East. He married Susan Godridge in 1889. Her father ran the Cobb & Co. in Morwell, and had just discovered the brown coal on the Latrobe River. William worked with Henry, that's Susan's father, to find investors and work the coal mine. However, after a few years, it wasn't profitable, and they moved on to other things. William's next job was building bridges with Bert Savage in the Narracan and Morwell Shires. This work was completed, and he turned his hand back to farming. In 1921, he turned back to coal mining with the SEC. As one of the first employees. He worked there until he retired in 1925. There, he bought a property on Marshall Street, where he built a house with his wife and lived there until he died. At the time of his death, he had 11 children, 40 grandchildren, and 8 great-grandchildren. In 1925, complaints were made that the camps, tents, and buildings were infested with rats. The need for people grew quicker than the perfectly planned and primed your lawn could cater for. That left the rest of the people living in rents in those camps, the East, West, and North camps. They were all considered to be part of the brown coal mine. The food in the camps was catered, and the men complained it was prepared in the most careless way. It was not palatable. Privacy was non-existent, and this put off many married people who wanted to bring their families to the brown coal mine. They couldn't make gardens because the dogs ran through them, destroying them. The most alarming complaint was that in the brown coal mine, fleas were so plentiful and strong they were able to lift a 10-stone man out of bed. Unfortunately, these issues were not addressed with expediency, which resulted in a mysterious epidemic that plagued the brown coal mine for 4 months. In 1928, the children were struck with a mysterious illness. For over a month, children died and the cause was unknown. Many people living in the camps were from European backgrounds and could be forgiven for thinking all manner of crazy things, like the Albanian legend, the Striga. It's a vampiric witch-like creature, coming and sucking the blood of the children at nighttime, changing into an insect to avoid detection. The legend says only the Striga can save its victims by spitting in the mouth. By the time 9 children had died, it looked like gastroenteritis was the cause, with a side dose of meningitis. The doctors said the poor sanitation conditions and off milk was helping cause this plague. The doctors advocated for things to be improved, and when they did, the children stopped getting sick. There is a creature that stalked these lands with tight-knit scales like a dragon, a jaw that clamped with a vice-like grip like a crocodile. Those scales were covered in great Aboriginal art, and the Aboriginal people called it a dirawong. It taught them all aspects of life, from art, medicine, and law. The dirawong is in a perpetual war with the rainbow serpent, the creator of the earth. The dirawong has been known to kill snakes. In fact, one lucky soul, I kid, it would have been the worst thing to see ever, witnessed the dirawong kill a tiger snake. The two creatures reared up at one another as though they found feet at the end of their tails. They lunged at one another, the snake using its fangs and venom, striking at the dirawong, attempting to puncture the dirawong's skin. The dirawong, with its big jaws, clamped down on the tiger snake, shook it, stunning the creature and sucking it down. Ugh. This was a fearsome creature. It survived the tiger snake's venom by seeking out a plant that countered the effects of the poison. This is the creature the State Electrical Commission workers found at Yulon, up a high-voltage tower. Because of its reputation, none of them were willing to go up and get it down for themselves, although they were worried it would destroy the power lines. They sent for a professional to remove it. This professional was Mr. Hort, who'd been working with the dirawong for a long time. He climbed the ladder to reach it. He was at the top of the ladder in the process of removing it when the dirawong's head snapped back and bit Mr. Hort on the back of his hand. It didn't have a good grip, but it did manage to take some skin with it. Mr. Hort managed to wrangle the Jurawong to the ground without further drama. Yet, he had a scar with him until the day he died. The Jurawong is also known as a sand goanna, or monitor goanna. It's a distant relative to the Komodo dragon. They are carnivorous and have been known to eat foxes' cubs, kill emus and other lizards. They grow on average to about 4.5 feet, but some have been found as big as 6 feet. It traverses through Gippsland from Hillsville to East Gippsland. You can still see them today. The open cut continued growing towards the town. This is how Main Street ended up on the edge of the mine. Today you can see that opposite the Old Brown Coal Mine Museum, there is an asphalt road. It's the fire track, where the town fireys used to run. It's sealed over 2nd Street, which was still there when they did that, and there were power lines lining the road. I call it the Road to Nowhere. It has a depth of history, from raging bushfires breaking its banks metres from the community, and collapsing twice. In the flames, one sees many things. There are many legends of fire, although out here in the bush, with so many close calls and 2 mine fires, the people of the Brown Coal Mine don't need legends. In 1929, the Brown Coal Mine was mainly made up of bush humpies and bag bungalows, and later, a wooden building built without nails. Panic ensued when the fire consumed the mine. Men, women, and children armed with buckets lined up along the bank of the mine to put out flames that overshot their heads. On 2 occasions, they thought their houses were going to burn. Thankfully, only 2 were lost on this occasion. It seems so frightening to me to be near a mine fire, especially because there was a mine fire there in 2006, and then in 2009, the infamous Hazelwood mine fire burned for almost 2 months. With current technology and highly skilled firefighters, it took ages to finish impacting the community. There is no way 200 or so citizens armed with buckets could have put that out. But the bravery, determination, and necessity of the time, the citizens had to do it for themselves. And they were successful. In 1944, there was a royal commission into this fire. It went into the mine, Yallourn and Brown Coal Mine, and was fought by all shifts of the men from the SEC. 50 trucks full of coal caught fire, causing mayhem. The electricity distribution was heavily impacted. 2,000 men were recalled, including firefighters, to fight back the flames, saving most of the structures and halting the fire in its tracks. Another story involving fire was on North Road in 1938. The O'Neills had a 5-roomed home here. They had 3 children. Mr. O'Neill may have been an engineer at the mine who knew how the mechanical drill worked. One night he wasn't home and his wife was outside when she heard the sickening crackle of flames coming from inside her home. Her children were asleep in one room. Fueled with adrenaline, she flew into the house and dragged them out with the help of her neighbours who followed her in. The flames consumed the entire property and all the contents. However, all of her children were saved. After her heroic efforts, she passed out on the front lawn and required medical attention. In 1914, William King worked from home as the grocer of the Brown Coal Mine and the agent for the State Savings Bank. He would go around to other local businesses and organise orders for them. One day, while William was out getting business, the bank was robbed. He noticed it later in the day when he was doing the cash reconciliation. Mr. William Cook was a local farmer, a great philanthropist. He helped the new Australians with loans, ploughing, and basic necessities. At a local charitable event, he entertained people with his tree chopping and steer riding abilities. He was a man who enjoyed working the land. He died while working in his hay shed. During World War II, anti-aircraft guns were built in between Boundary Road and Anderson Avenue. Beneath the houses are still the bases. Ammunition can also be found there. The sound of a plane engine was drowned out as the sirens blared. Gunners raced to their positions as an unidentified aircraft flew into the area. Citizens jumped into the closest foxhole, raising everybody's anxiety. It ended up being a private plane who did respond when the army officials threatened to shoot it down. Everything changed after World War II. There was much more money, and the state government started helping the locals build proper housing. Except for on the north side of North Road, that was still considered private land, and residents there had to build their own homes and even pay for sealing the roads. We still had strong and fascinating people living here. We're going to explore their lives next. In 1948, George Gorbel came out as a quote-unquote single man who signed a work contract with the Australian government. His wife Anna and firstborn Yania were in Italy awaiting passage to Australia because each boat was only allowed to carry 12 families. George was a displaced person at the time, today a refugee, because he was unable to return to his home country of Ukraine as the Russians had taken it over. On the ship, Mr. Gorbel met many men who he would reunite with at Yallourn North. George spent 9 months without his family working on different sites around Australia's southeast. He worked on the Rockland Dam project, the canal from Balmoral to Horsham. He worked on cleaning the pumps. Eels regularly got caught in there. And a perk to this job was he was able to sell those eels for money or a full cask of wine. The person he sold them to would immediately eat the small ones raw, much to George's discomfort. In April 1949, Anna and Yania arrived in Australia. They stayed at Cowra, New South Wales, in a camp where George was able to visit them. When George went to Yallourn, he asked to have his family moved to Woodside, South Australia, a migrant camp, because Anna had a friend there who she met on the boat over, who was also going to South Australia. Anna and George were on the train heading in opposite directions at the same time. Once George arrived in the Brown Coal Mine, the accommodation he was assigned to was at the West Camp, over near the location of the Yallourn W station. Then he moved to the North Camp, which is the location of the skate park today. However, at both these locations, he was unable to bring his family with him, so he started finding other accommodations. He finally found accommodation with Mrs. Guzzardi. She was a one-parent home. She had also been the only parent at home when a fire broke out in their five-roomed home, made of iron and wood. She managed to save all four of her children, from the 18-month-old to the 9-year-old. It was said a lack of water in the town created problems for the Yallourn Fire Brigade to put out the fire in 1938. In 1948, Mrs. Guzzardi lost her husband. She knew both homelessness and separation. She had a strict routine in her home and wouldn't cook until 6 p.m. Whereas George was getting home from the SEC around 4 p.m, eating and leaving to clear his block. Anna obtained a stove and was cooking meals in their room. Mrs. Guzzardi was not happy when she discovered and asked her to cook in the shed. Before the house standing there today was built, they lived in a two-room bungalow. There is still a concrete slab where that was. George and Anna cleared the land to create pasture land. Mr. Cook ploughed their paddock for the first year or so. For the first year, George and Anna planted potatoes. The next year, George borrowed a horse from Mr. Nardino, until he finally bought his own horse. One day, the horse George owned kicked him unconscious. Mrs. Petty, a neighbour, found him and gave him mouth to mouth. The fall didn't affect his ability to strategize for life or best any opponent at draughts and chess. He could also sand a piece of wood without sandpaper using glass, and the job would be better than if he had have used sandpaper. By 1950, town water was not connected to the Gorbel's lot. Anna had to bring her laundry to the Catholic Church and use one of the only hydrants in town to do the washing. Anna picked up English quickly and often interpreted for other European people at the Purvis's store. George at 29 came out with nothing. But he said, "Here, I lived like a king." Mr. George Georgevic, known in Serbia as Drago, came to Australia on the Nally in 1949 with his family. However, when they arrived, Petraja and the children were sent to a camp in Bonegilla, New South Wales. Drago, along with other migrant men from the Nally, chose to work at Yallourn. There he drove locos for the SEC. For Drago, this was his only job in Australia for his whole 40-year working life. Drago wanted to be reunited with his wife, Pat is her Australianised name, and their child, Dragana. The only way for this to occur was to move out of the camp and into a home. He moved into a hayshed on Nardino's property, who were very helpful to many migrant families. The property was sack walls, an open fire, and a dam for bathing past muster, and his family were sent to him. Their first Australian home. 4 other migrant families lived there with them. They have good memories from this place. Drago's eldest daughter, Dragana, along with her cousin, both at 5 years old, spoke Yugoslav German, understood Russian and Polish, but not a stitch of English. They went off to the local primary school. Fortunately, the school had lots of migrant children, and in no time they picked up English. Drago built their first home of their own, on land they bought from the Nardinos, on Nardino Road. They raised chickens, pigs, and had a huge veggie patch, with fruit trees and an outside dunny. Weekends consisted of bushwalking, swimming in the creek, catching yabbies, and picking blackberries. Sometimes they'd help others in the community build their homes. Nardino's Road is 3 kilometres out of town, which means the kids had to walk into town for school, and even pictures on the weekend. The picture theatre in your lawn north was on School Avenue near the swimming pool behind the cricket grounds today. There used to be a road that also went up through the cricket ground, just for fun. So being so far out of town led them to sell the house. They rented in town while building a house on the corner of Rossmore Avenue and John Street. The house is still there today, but the family has moved on. This was the house they were most proud of. As a family of 7, they moved into their 3rd house, a 4-bedroom brick with a sunroom, big open kitchen and dining lounge room. They were so proud of this house. In 1956, they bought a Black Singer car. They have really great memories from the brown coal mine in Yulon North. Another local, Vorja Brunkov, had a vision for a Serbian Orthodox church in Yulon North. Vorja set out without a car to visit about 40 Serbian families to share the vision of building a spiritual home. This vision was taken up by other members of the Serbian community, like the Jordovics. Originally, the Serbian community started meeting in the Church of England, with their permission, of course. While the community grew, they went about securing their own land on the highest hill in Yulon North. There they planted a tree on the site of the church land. In 1952, the chapel was completed. In 1967, they added a church hall, and it was extended in the 1990s. Since then, many Serbians have moved out of Yulon North. The church runs monthly, and sometimes local members come here and share meals. Celebrations called Slava, where they have a pig on a spit, chicken soup, and salads, are enjoyed. Members of the community have always been welcome, and those who went have fond memories. The church was a big part of the Chvordovics' life. Their mother Pat helped along with other women to cater events. Olga and Dragana were both married at the little church on the hill. Dragana was married before 1967, so there was no space for the reception at the church. And her reception was held at the Yulon North Fire Station. The fire station used to be on 3rd Street as well, on the same site where the school is, but on court area. In 1952, Yulon North made the news for causing postal workers to go postal, along with Richmond and Traralgon South. The reason they made the news is because when the brown coal mine changed its name to Yulon North, letter writers would shorten it to Yulon, much to the chagrin of postal workers and locals alike. Yulon North had so much more history because it had been the brown coal mine. Letter writers writing to Richmond would assume there was only one in Australia, not realising there was a Richmond in Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia. Letter writers for Traralgon South would also drop it to just Traralgon. This too was unhelpful. Thank you so much for listening. I really want to thank the families of Yulon North who shared their stories with us. Thank you again, listeners, for your time and ears. I hope you've had a fascinating journey through the brown coal mine, people in history, wherever you are. This podcast was produced, researched, written and narrated by me, Tegan Dawson, on Gunai Kurnai land in Moi, Victoria, which was never ceded. Sound engineering and music by Aaron Austin Music.